From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at a farm in Haiti, where a little girl spent her summers with her grandmother. The farm was off the grid. There were no built roads, no cars, no noise pollution. In her later years, she described the scene as idyllic. When she was 16, the girl moved with her family to the United States. She said the change came with the loss of everything familiar, and it was immediate and unbearable. She missed her friends, her extended family, and some of the places that she loved dearly. But her love of nature carried her through. She wrote, quote, "Nature is the infinite teacher of everything I have ever needed to navigate my new country, and from nature I learned to understand human beings, including myself," end quote. That girl was Lucienne Nicholson. And she promised herself at a young age that she would one day provide access to nature for all American kids, regardless of their socioeconomic standing, their race, physical differences. Her organization, Inclusive Woods and Us, does just that. She created it in 2019, and since then she has been inviting people to join her on outdoor excursions. Easy hikes served as the foundation for introducing diverse groups of people to connect with nature spiritually, mentally, and physically. Nicholson says race and income are the two most significant factors blocking equitable access to the outdoors, with many people in marginalized populations living in dense urban areas that lack a lot of green space. This hour, we talk with Lucienne Nicholson about the mission of Inclusive Woods and Us, and about how nature can empower those who spend time in it. And I'd like to welcome our guest. The founder and executive director of Inclusive Woods and Us is Lucienne Nicholson. Welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Evan. If I just have done an incredible job with the introduction, it's so empowering to hear your own voice, your own spirit reflected back at you, and for sharing my message, not only with just Rochester, but to the United States of America.
Well, it's great.
And it is true that I did arrive here when I was 16 years old.
Well, it's great to have you, and there's a lot more to talk about. And also with us on the program, Clifton Harkham is the director of the Division of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at SUNY Potsdam. Clifton, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you, and this is going to be incredible.
I certainly hope so. This is a lot of pressure, but I hope so. Chandra Pointer is the event chair at the REI Inclusion Network at REI in Rochester. Welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, and I love that introduction. I got goosies on that one.
Well, that's Lucienne's story, and so maybe I will let Lucienne Nicholson tell us if there's more that you want to add to your story when you think about the impact of making this move, the change in your life, and how important it was to still be able to connect with nature. How difficult were those initial days for you?
Well, I came from Haiti, so the Caribbean, and I landed in Brooklyn in January, and it was snowing. So that was not the way to transition.
Had you seen snow?
But never before. Mm-hmm. And I've never felt cold before. It did introduce me to knowledge that I will be using later, in the sense that I know what it feels like when you're not properly covered in the wintertime. And that is an impediment for people without money who want to go into nature for seasons.
Well, and to be clear here, Port-au-Prince is very different than your grandmother's farm. Is that fair?
Absolutely. So therefore, I have this bifurcated way of seeing where we stand. So that's why I understand so clearly what it's like to be with nature and what it's like to be without nature, outside of the scientific studies, both quantifiable and qualitative science that speaks to that. But I have lived both of them. So you're right. This is like night and day.
And your grandmother was a coffee and cacao farmer. Is that right?
Yes, totally.
And so could you tell me a little bit about what it is like being on a coffee farm? I mean, I really believe, Lucienne, that American coffee culture, to the extent that we love good coffee, we're still often very disconnected from those who grow it and what their lives are like.
Absolutely. My grandmother's farm, the orchard where she grew her coffee, actually were the proper way under the canopy of very tall trees. And the sunlight was broken up by the foliage overhead. And the trees were low enough, even as a tiny girl. I'm not a very tall person. I'm 5 feet tall. So I was always very small. But even then, I was able to help with the harvest of the berries because of the way that they were growing low and hanging under the tall canopies of other trees. And they're gorgeous. They look like cranberry a little bit, American cranberry, but they'll be variegated colors of yellow and gold and red. And we will, I'll have the benefit of walking on moist soil under this coffee orchard. Nothing was ever very dry. Everything was done naturally. My grandmother didn't use any kind of chemical assistance on her farm. So it was truly a witnessing of the life cycle when it works out properly.
Are you a coffee drinker?
Absolutely. Nothing but the best.
Were you drinking coffee at 16 in those summers on your grandmother's farm?
I was drinking coffee at 2. They'll put it in your bottle, but they call it third run. So they will do coffee for the elders, which will be something that will knock your socks off. And then they'll do it for the teenagers. And then by the time they get to the little one, they do a third run of the same coffee mash. So it looks brown. It was really not coffee, but it was a good initiation, if you will.
And now, if you could, let's kind of fast forward a little bit to your before we get to the United States, tell me a little bit more about what you learned while you were living there. I know you talk about understanding how things get recycled, and I'm not just talking about plastic. I'm talking about the earth itself and how nature sort of decays and is then reborn. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yes, because my grandmother on her farm, the concept of weeds was not something that I learned until I came to America. So there's always something to be harvested to eat, which we call foraging here. And then also we have the situation where everything will grow in such a way that they were allowed, something would be allowed to seemingly die, but they don't need to regenerate the soil. And my grandmother will do rolling planting where she will rotate her crops. And she will also create crops according to seasons. So we know exactly what we could eat, when we could eat it, when we could have it. So you take advantage of it. Everything was always harvested when it was ready from the tree, from the bush. So the food was delectable and healthy and packed with nutrition, which is really necessary when you're raising young bodies. The setting was idyllic, and everything my grandmother did was according to the rhythm of nature. So I always knew what was coming. But also I learned about the power of nature to nurture us, to feed us, and also to withhold. Because sometimes the harvest wouldn't come. So the farmer also has to have that in mind, what happened if there's too much rain or if the summer was too dry. So I really learned the cadence of nature, the rhythm of nature, the power of nature, and the respect and reverence I have for nature today is because of the summers I spent on my grandmother's farm.
You said that at the time you weren't aware of the concept of weeds. What do you mean by that?
Oh, well, I think I'm a farmer. So I used to live in Florida where everybody knows that I'm the woman who thinks she has a farm. So I grow food on my suburban lot in the backyard. And where I live in Rochester, I live in one of the suburbs. I have I moved to the suburb for the reason so I can farm. I can have enough land. So I do run a little farm in my backyard, and I have a very well-maintained wilderness in the front yard. And people oftentimes come and tell me, your garden would be beautiful if you're not for the weeds. And the concept of weeds to me is new because everything was embraced. There was always a need to discover what is this thing doing. Is it maintaining the soil? Is it something you can eat? Is it something the birds may need? Perhaps your horses, your cows. They see everything as necessary and important. So there was never a weed. It was something for you to discover what it was meant to do.
Yeah, in this country, we spend a lot of time pulling weeds. We spend a lot of time spraying weeds. We spend a lot of time trying to make our grass perfectly monoculture in a front yard. And then we get upset if anybody walks on the grass. It's probably very different than what you grew up with.
Yes, absolutely. We didn't grow lawn, not on my grandmother's farm. Whatever was on the food, maybe it will be wild thyme or any kind of beautiful flowery ground cover, just Mother Nature put there, and you walk on it, and the rest of it will be decomposing leaves that has fallen from all the untold number of trees to the ground. And so the ground was nicely carpeted. And in other places where we had what we call a chantier, which is like a footpath, that's where the horses and the donkeys and humans will traffic. And after it's been raining a while, you have a nice muddy path of way of clay soil. I remember that as a child, very squishy between the toes. And you walk right through that too. It's just like there was a complete communion with nature, and this is why I feel this is the greatest enrichment that I could have ever gotten.
Yeah, I my summer memories include hearing from people who were growing pristine lawns and then saying to kids, get off the lawn. Why are you walking on the grass? I'm going, at what point in the year is it going to be okay to walk on this green stuff? It's very different. Now, you lived in the East Flatbush District of Brooklyn in New York City, and I know it was a community of immigrants from different Caribbean nations. And what you sort of had to discover that you weren't that far from green space, but you weren't necessarily welcome there. Or there was even a concern about, I guess, trespassing over certain lines. Tell me about that.
Indeed. This is a site of trauma and will always be a site of trauma, but also it's a site that also brings me a lot of energy and determination to do the work I'm doing, Woods and Us. When I came to America, I didn't know about the civil rights movement yet. I didn't know about gentrification. I didn't know about redlining. I didn't know about busing. I just presumed from the America that I saw in movies, that I saw in books, was an America where it was the land of opportunity for all. After all, this is what we learn about America when you don't live here. So this is why we come. This is the dream that we're pursuing. When I arrived to Brooklyn, there were four siblings who were still young, and myself at that time became the oldest because the other siblings have gotten married. So I was separated from my three other siblings because they sent me to a school far away. I think now we call it urban suburban. The name changes, but the intention is the same. So I was taken out of my community where I felt somewhat comfortable, even though it wasn't Haiti. And I had to ride long distances, leaving at 6:30 in the morning to get to my high school for 7:30 a.m. class, which you couldn't be late for, of course. And in my community where I live, I was really missing green spaces. I often wondered, where could I go so I can have access to abundant green spaces, because I miss my grandmother's farm. As the seasons were changing and I was riding that bus to my suburban, well-to-do community high school where I was bused to, then I started noticing the parks and I started noticing the tree-lined streets and the beautiful backyards. And I said to myself, because when you're an immigrant, you're bold, you have big vision, you really believe in this American dream concept. So I told myself at 16, so there are two Americas. And I guess you can choose which one you want. After all, this is America, the place of freedom. So I'm going to choose this new America that I have discovered. Literally, that was the conversation I was having in my head. So then I went home giddily. I tell my mother, I found another America. We don't have to live here like this. I'm going to move us to this other America. I'm going to find out how we're going to get there. Because my parents work 5 and 7 days. My mother worked 7 days. My father worked 5, but very hard days. And they were determined to give us that American dream. And I knew that they will cobble together every penny that they have to make sure that we have every opportunity that can come to us in America. But then I discovered through new friends I was making were born in America, descendant of slaves who came here, whereas I'm descended from slaves who landed in Haiti. And I learned from them, and I learned from the other earlier immigrants from Jamaica and Trinidad as such. And then I learned from the few white students at that school where I was bused to that you don't do that in America, that I will be trespassing, that I'll be entering spaces that where I'm not allowed to be, and that harm will come my way if I dare do that. And I didn't believe them because to me that the concept was so insane and not to be believed. So the more I asked about it, the more I was convinced that, and people said, no, don't do it because you will be harmed. And I did test it, you know what, Evan? I tested it because I did try to put together what English word I knew at the time, and then I will copy down numbers to buildings that I liked for my families to move to because they have beautiful trees, the streets were clean and nice, and I wanted to be there too. And I will take down the numbers, and I will go home. That was before cell phone. And I will call to try to get an apartment for my parents, my families, my siblings. And, I've been in America 47 years. I still have my accent, and I'll always have it. So if you can imagine what I sounded like at first year in America, they couldn't figure me out. When I showed up, I was threatened with physical threat if I didn't leave. I was probably 90 pounds wet, and men and women, grown adults, were saying they'll call the police on me if I didn't leave. They didn't want my kind to live there. So both the white students who told me that at that high school and my black friends in my community where I live in Brooklyn of immigrants were telling the truth. And that's when I discover this America is going to keep me separated from the American dream they've promised to the world. And it was my business to figure out how to change it for myself and what I can do for as long as I live in America to make sure this is no longer a truth.
I want to wrap up Lucy Ann's story, and then we'll talk to Clifton and Chandra about not only some of their reactions to this story, but what we do about that legacy now, because so much of their effort now is making sure that we're not repeating this. You write about moving to Florida and being able to sort of commune with the ocean. The ocean never rejected you. I mean, you shared a lot of stories with the ocean. But eventually you end up in Pittsburgh, and you have a musing on fear that I would love for you to share with listeners, because you write that, you know, everybody has fear, but you said that your white suburban friends have some fears that you share, some you don't. I mean, for example, maybe they're scared of a bear, the fear of poison ivy that might show up in their yard, fear of getting lost. But then you say what we don't have in common is the fear of rejection and physical safety. Tell me about that.
Absolutely. What is unique to have that beautiful skin that I have, that beautiful brown hue, dark hue, black hue, whatever that I have, is that when it is used as a weapon against you, it is seen before you are even recognized in your humanity. So this is not something that my white friends can relate to, my white neighbors can relate to. The fact that your skin is your condemnation, you don't even have a right to your humanity. You don't get to speak. You don't get to present yourself. There's no discovery necessary. Your skin is your condemnation. This is something that this humanity, the people continuing to advance this ideology, need to sit down with and think about and need to understand why it must be eradicated. It must be erased. It cannot exist. When you think about it, it cannot exist. So they don't have that fear. They get to present themselves all the way to their final destination, and perhaps they don't even have to prove anything beyond their skin. But in case they have to prove something beyond their skin color, they are given the opportunity to get close to proximity to do that. We are not given that opportunity. And this is one fear that I talk about. The other fear that my neighbors in Pittsburgh and my friends, and I do have good friends who are white in Pittsburgh, and what they don't have is that their children started driving at 16. My children started driving at 21, not because they are dents in their heads. They cannot learn how to drive and get a driver's license. Not because I couldn't get them a car or they couldn't borrow my car. It's because they don't have the freedom of their peers, their neighbors, the same children they sit next to, the same children they play with, can have their driver's license at 16 because the mothers, the fathers don't have to worry about them driving while black. They don't have to about that phone call in the middle of the night. They don't have to about somebody questioning their child, did you steal that car? Is this your car? Well, we're going to keep you here until your mom can come. They don't have to worry about their children taking a ride in their own community, going a distance in their community, and people wondering if they live there, should they call the police? So these fears, no matter how much my white friends support me and care about me, and love me and want to protect me, they can't even protect me from it. Mm. The only way that can change that is for the people who are doing it to work with themselves and to stop it, because I have nothing to do with it. The people doing it need to stop it. So these are the fears that I have, that no matter how much money, how much education that I acquire in this America of the land of the free, the freedom has yet to be acquired until the people who speak the words of freedom understand the meaning of freedom.
And your husband's from the Adirondack region?
In fact, yes, I am. I was once divorced since yes, and I moved to Rochester as a divorced woman, and I married my husband, and I'm an authentically living woman. My husband is a white man. He's from the North Country, and he grew up a lot of his life without seeing anybody who looks like me. And that hasn't changed much for the North Country. And I'm sure Clifton is going to be able to tell us something more about that.
So, yeah, Clifton, you want to add to that? That's an interesting observation. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'm originally from Baltimore City, located in Maryland. And I've moved up to the North Country about 3 years ago. I originally stayed in Watertown, and now I live up in the, I recently just moved, but I've lived in the Adirondacks. And it's a different world. It's a different world from what I thought it would be moving up to the North Country. You know, when you're from the city and you hear New York, you think a certain thing. And moving up to the North Country, I learned that it's not what you may think it is.
And what is one of the, I don't know, adaptation is not the right word, but how do you navigate a world that is pretty white and, as Lucien has described, is often not welcoming, but it is, you know, where you want to be, it's where you want to work, and what do you do about that?
Well, I think my perspective is different. Maybe it's because of where I come from. Like I said, I come from the inner city, and Baltimore is a pretty tough city. So my transition to the North Country, it wasn't that difficult. I've dealt with implicit bias. I've dealt with some things since I've been up here. People talking down to me all kinds of ways. But I guess my approach is I belong here. my thing is no one's going to stop me from living in America and doing what I want to do. And if they're being racist or they're being judgmental based off of the color of my skin, then that's their problem. But I'm going to experience what I came up here to experience, which is the outdoors. That's the reason why I actually moved to the North Country to get involved in the outdoors, because of all of that it had to offer.
Yeah, and so, Clifton, what are the ways that we create a country that is truly allowing kids to feel and connect with nature, no matter their socioeconomic upbringing, their race, et cetera?
Well, I think it's several things. Like I said, my perspective is whether people want you there or not, you need to go there because you have every right to. So when it comes to making the outdoors more welcoming, I have certain things that I think we need to see more of, more black and brown rangers. We need to have when you spoke about the transportation situation, making sure that it's transportation to get people to a lot of these sites. In the Adirondacks, it's a lot of woods, it's a lot of highways, and a lot of times you don't have cell signal. And if you don't have a car, you really can't get around at all, especially if you're looking at the Adirondack region. There's been plenty of times where, you know, people in the community may want to hike a mountain or they might want to get into a space, but they don't have transportation to get there. So I don't know. I think it comes down to your attitude. It really depends on the individual. When I grew up in Baltimore, the closest thing I got to outdoor recreation was a little playground on some concrete, yeah. You know. So I guess it all depends on the individual. But I know there are some, you know, as a person of color, as a black man, there are those fears of going into the outdoors in an all-white, predominantly white region, especially being up in the North Country where people up north, believe it or not, are flying Confederate flags in a lot of those small towns. So it does give you a sense of danger. You're not from the place. A lot of people are born and raised here. They know these woods like the back of their hands. They hunt, you know. And when you see Confederate flags in various places up north, you know that it's not just one person. It's people who feel that you shouldn't be here and look at you as a threat or look at you as someone that needs to be done away with. So being out in nature, you kind of always walk around with that fear in the back of your mind that something could happen. You might not make it home.
Do you ever confront a Confederate flag if you see it on someone's door, on someone's car, or do you leave it alone?
Honestly, why would I?
Yeah.
What would be the purpose?
Yeah. I mean there's probably danger.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't really see the point of it. Yeah. You know, I really don't. But, you know, America still says that's a flag that people can legally fly. So what can you really say to them?
Yeah. Oh, boy.
I think it's really despicable, to be honest with you.
Chandra Pointer, can you give me a sense for what the REI Inclusion Network aims to be doing and the role that you have here?
Well, it's cool to sort of follow, right, the two great conversations because, you know, what's really cool is I so connect to Lucianne. I was a part of the Urban Suburban Program here in Rochester. I grew up in the city. I grew up in Van Arker Projects. And so to much what Clifton said, my playground was cement. You know, when we were getting ready to play, I had to move, you know, glass and whatever else mm-hmm. debris was in our way. And so that was our outdoor. And so, you know, my sense and what resonates on both those conversations was just really having that sense of belonging, right? And so for me, I didn't have that sense of choice that Lucianne talked about, right? The way that I grew up is I was other. I was other, and so that was what I was surrounded with. That's what I thought about. And so in my own little community, right, I am a rock star, big fish or whatever. I don't feel the other. Then I get, you know, I go to school. I'm shipped to the Pennsylvania School District from the inner city, and now I'm other, right? Now I'm feeling less than. Now I'm dealing with those microaggressions and not even understanding what those are and how they are affecting me as I now going to, you know, venture into adulthood. So stepping into REI, the very first time I experienced an REI was through a program I was running with Black Girls Run. And I had gone there for an event, and I didn't see folks that looked like me at all, whether it was, you know, folks that worked there or people that shopped there. You know, we went right back to that room. It was a community of black and brown women, and we were there for a program. And so that was my first exposure to REI, in which at that time I called it RE. And so coming from that and then just kind of talking about community and making these connections, you know, as an adult, I got a chance to really understand how I was also, you know, had a right to these green spaces and these outdoors. I didn't get that until I was in my 40s. I didn't get that until I was in my 40s. So now, you know, I'm done with college. I have my own child. I am living in spaces that I don't understand and feeling very much like an imposter because I never had that sense of I belong. It was I cracked in somehow, don't know how, but now I'm this imposter sitting there. So coming back to Rochester, living in the New York City area, in New Jersey area, I'm on a trail training for the New York City Marathon, and I'm on that Erie Canal Trail running, and I run past that REI, but on my way back, I see that ReStore that I happen to have gone into one time for an event, right? And I'm like, okay, you know, I'm here to do one thing, to help take care of an ailing family member. And now I kind of want to break in, have a little space of my own. So I'm going to grab a part-time job. You know what? I'm going to go into that ReStore that I went into, walk into the Rochester REI. And again, I don't see myself there. But I know that they're looking for space in the running world. And I'm a runner, so I'm going to go interview. I interview. I'm the only black person to include interviewee and interviewer. Everybody's wearing flannel and boots, and I'm running. I got my Black Girls Run T-shirt on and some race shorts or something like that. Completely foreign, right? Completely other in that space. But, you know, if you know anything about the imposter syndrome, right, you get a little bit of courage, right? So I'm riding on this running courage, and I'm in this room, and I belong, right? And I'm going to take my little running self, and I am going to belong to this store. Cut to being a part of this store. And now I'm in this store, and I am the only one in this store, and I got customers that are challenging my knowledge, right? Because for them, I am not a part of what they consider outdoorsy. And I, right, I'm not even considering myself outdoorsy. I'm now considering myself as someone who's eked into this space, right, because I'm a runner and I've happened to have fallen in, right? So no full foundation of confidence here, no chest pressing out, right? I'm just here and I'm trying to survive. And again, these tiny little microaggressions. Now, I was fortunate enough to have, colleagues who were trying to be supportive, but still in my own mind, I'm other. So fear is coming up, customers coming to me. I now get to give my whole resume in order to sell a pair of shoes where my, you know, white male colleague can just say, hey, I like them, and boom, that's a purchase, right? And so, you know, being a part of REI as an inspired guide, it was, you know, a year of really gaining courage. And then REI, had been working prior to the whole George Floyd and what that brought us. They had been working on really trying to create a space for all. And they had been working on these inclusion networks. And, you know, coming from corporate America and having some skill sets, I was like, hey, I can actually apply for this leadership role here in Rochester in my inspired guide capacity, and I'm now working with folks in corporate. And so I find myself as an events and a logistics chair at REI, and my role is to actually build community and get folks together. You know, one of the really great things that REI did, and a lot of companies did this after George Floyd and the protests that were going on, a lot of companies had conversations with their African Americans. You know, I had, at that point, was working with two different stores, and one conversation was like, oh, yeah, let's give the black and brown people money. And REI held these calls and like, what can we do? How can we create this community? And so for me, where I really start to feel like I belong was, number one, literally being on this, you know, call in which I now see other black folks, right, in REI. Mm-hmm. You know, I knew they existed, but I couldn't see them, right, being in this small Rochester store. And so being able to see a community just really made a huge, huge, huge difference for me. And so being able to create that, right, bringing an event for Black History Month for the first time to REI, that's pretty exciting for what we did for our BIPOC inclusion network. Bringing Juneteenth. We brought a two-day festival of Juneteenth to REI and having folks ask questions. What does the red mean? Why is the flag different? What's happening? And learning the difference and the real significance of Juneteenth. Not that it's just a celebration, but it is also about, you know, black and brown bodies who absolutely had no idea that they were free for 2.5 years, right? And so those are the things that I am working with and I have the pleasure to bring together. And in all of this, learn more about my right to be wherever I want to be, right? I'm going to spend, for the very first time, I'm going to the Adirondacks in a week. And so knowing I belong there, instead of happening to be there or, you know, feeling like somehow I got there and trying to hide, right, trying to hide who I am. Now I'm boldly going to be able to go because in this whole process of having community at my back, I know I belong. And on those days where I feel like I might, I've got people saying, absolutely you belong. Absolutely your voice matters.
Chandra, if I could, I've got to squeeze in an early break in a second, but let me just ask you, excuse me, one more quick question on that. When you talk about working for REI and having this moment in a company that was asking questions about how to do it better, a lot of companies, as we've talked about on this program, they'll do a workshop. They do sort of what looks like the minimum to claim that they're inclusive. It's another to ask your black and brown employees, what are we doing here? What do we need to change? And actually listening. And it sounds like that's happening.
Absolutely. I'm going to tell you, it was what kept me there. It was what kept me there, and it made that shift from working, you know, these two different companies. One company in which, you know, I can talk all day and say, as a black woman, this is what I need. And they're like, okay, we'll give you some money. We'll throw money at it. And really not listening to what I need, right? Forget about the money. We need that as well. Yes, yes, yes. But what else do I need? And then having REI say, here's a platform. Here's what we're willing to do. And what else can we do? And also having these anti-racist, you know, conversations and trainings. And it's just so different.
Three great perspectives on the program this hour. And after we take our only break, we're going to ask all of them to tell us a little bit more about what they're working on next here. You just heard Chandra Poynter, who is event chair at the REI Inclusion Network at REI in Rochester. Clifton Harkham, director of the Division of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at SUNY Potsdam. And Lucienne Nicholson, founder and executive director of Inclusive Woods and Us. And we're right back with them next. Coming up in our second hour, ethics reform legislation in Monroe County blew up this week. There was a bit of a problem with what the lawmakers had put together, and they had to start over. So what should ethics reform look like at a time when trust in government is down? We're talking ethics and the law next hour.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Lucienne Nicholson, so we've heard your stories. Now tell us more about what Inclusive Woods and Us is aiming to do now and how you want people to be involved.
Fabulous. Thank you so much. A great question. There's so many things that we engage in and we can get help from. First of all, I'd like to mention that we have, for example, a training class going on tomorrow at Webster Park, and we hope to have 30 local residents of Rochester trained as hike leaders to help Woods and Us lead more hikes for more children and family in the city of Rochester. Additionally, I have to say that this class is a gift from the Adirondack Lodge head of outdoor education, Seth Jones, who happens to be a native of Greece, New York, and is in town visiting family. And he has decided that the mission that Inclusive Woods and Us, for short, Woods and Us, has proposed for this community, that has proposed as a model for elsewhere, is a mission that is worth pursuing and developing and supporting. For that reason, he's donating his Saturday. Instead of being with family and friends in town, he's going to be teaching hike leaders for us tomorrow. So I am thankful to Seth Jones, who cannot be with us on this hour because he has to be with family today. In addition, the courtesy, the hard work of the ADI, the Adirondack Diversity Initiative, of which Clifton here on the line is a member, through the hard work of Clifton, through collaboration of our relationship between ADI and Woods and Us, We are. When Chandra said she is going to the Adirondack for the first time next Saturday, it is because of the work that Clifton and I are doing together to collapse, to contract, to reduce the space of separation that people experience when they try to go far away to discover the big woods of America. Look, in our state of New York. So we are taking 19 residents of the city of Rochester to the Adirondacks, an all-expenses-paid adventure that is really will not be affordable to nearly all of us. And through the hard work of ADI and Clifton Harcum, we are going to be able to have a weekend starting the 30th of July. We'll be there the 30th, the 31st, until the 1st of August. So a three-day bonanza of fun, of initiating people into the big woods, of breaking fears and barriers, of showing up for ourselves, and also becoming messengers and ambassadors. We can come back home and let the rest of us know what's happening out there, what's available to us, and what is possible. So this is all the things that are coming immediately. Outside of that, we are raring to go. We have heart, we have intellectual capacity, we have knowledge, we have determination. What we don't have, we have a lot of support from far away, like the Adirondacks, the Catskill region in Albany, all the way in Montana, Oregon. We have a lot of support from far away. We are not feeling the support locally yet. We are 3 years ongoing this. We're still outside of REI, who is our biggest donor. We really have not seen any significant financial support from any of the organizations, the capacity to really move this forward. We haven't been able to get financial support and funding in at the level that will be necessary to take many children, especially the entire school district, out to the outdoors on a regular basis. We don't have that capacity, and that's what we're working very hard at, to expose our mission, to share our message, to show what I mean, the founder myself, I'm able to do nationally to connect with people, to have them buy into the vision, to want them to support us from far away. What we want is some local love so that we can then build capacity, we can hire people. I'm one woman, I'm determined, and I'm very, very, very committed, hardworking, but I'm still one woman. My board also, we only 9 people. And the volunteers we have, they have other lives also. So we need to see this organization supported because it is a worthy organization. The cause is historically grounded, and the need could not have been greater for the population of the children and family that we are targeting, because they're the one who needs this the most. So this is our plan for next year. The plan is here. Will we get the funding to do it? That is the next question. But I am determined. By high or low, it will happen. So our determination is to take as many children and family in the city who want to experience that wellness in nature and belongingness in nature.
Clifton Harcum, floor is yours. What are you working on that you want people to understand?
Well, I just wanted to kind of piggyback off of what Lucianne said. I'll have to tell you that Lucianne and I, she contacted me out of the blue. I guess you read about me somewhere. I do a lot of work out here in the Adirondacks. I'm really involved in nature, hiking, prior to the pandemic. And we planned on bringing a group up, I guess then, but the pandemic hit and, you know, everything was kind of shut down with social distancing. So now that we have the opportunity to actually start putting those plans into action, you know, I'm excited. I'll have to say that Lucianne's heart for her city, for her people in her city, it's genuine. And that's one of the reasons why we're working so hard to make sure that this her group, when they come up, that they actually have an experience that they will never forget. I respect Lucianne's dedication to her community. And coming from a city and understanding the challenges of growing up in a city and not having either the access or thinking that it's possible for you to do it or having those fears, I get it. And we just need to dispel those beliefs because people are missing out. You know, the woods are therapeutic, you know. It changes things. So, you know, we need that as a people. And we need to know that the woods are for us, outdoor, in nature. We belong there, too. And I think that's a big challenge growing up in the inner city, especially if you grow up in a community that's black and brown. So I just wanted to really say that about my relationship and the ADI's relationship with Lucianne and Inclusive Words in Us.
And Chandra Pointer, what's coming up next here as part of what you're doing for the REI Inclusion Network at REI?
So just continuing to build those communities and just, making sure that all of our folks of color that work with us are feeling very much like they are a part of this whole team, and that we are just as outdoorsy as the typical folks that are looked at as outdoorsy. But my main focus is also being that foot soldier for Woods and Us. That's really important for me, having grown up in the inner cities of Rochester and understanding the needs. Rochester is a very different landscape and environment, right? And sometimes breaking down those barriers and getting folks to understand the actual value behind this is what I'm hoping to bring to the table, because that was me. Right? That was me. My world opened up once I understood and really engaged in the outdoors. And then it really led to international travel and running and playing in the outdoors from outside of what I understood in that tiny little projects of Van Arker. And so that's my main goal, is to really, become a very solid hike leader and performer, and bringing all kinds of visual understanding of what we are planning to do and what we're going to be doing in the Rochester area with Woods and Us. So I want to be a big, big presence for both REI. So when folks are coming in and getting that gear, they do see someone that they connect to and relate to and looks like them. And also for Woods and Us, so that folks who have never been out could also see, hey, I can do that too.
Well, that's great. And, Lucianne, you mentioned that in the next year you've got your vision. It's a question of whether you get your funding. Tell me what it looks like 5 years from now if you are rolling with exactly what you want to be doing.
Wow. I believe in the empowerment of the individual. My vision for 5 years from now is that just about every child in the city of Rochester will have had access to 4 seasons of outdoors experiences. And nature is not something that you do. Nature may have seasons, but experiencing nature is not something seasonal that you do once in a while. To get the wellness that we need from nature, you need to be with nature all the seasons, all the time. So I would like to see children and families going there and continuously be able to access it with transportation in place to get them there. Having gotten the education that they need, as Clifton said, to change the old thinking, changing paradigms. To see these children, you're talking 5 years from now, some of them are youth who are 15 years old, some of them will be teenagers and are children who's 18 years old today, is to see them. The approach is holistic. I see them run, being park rangers. I see them studying law to be the next head of EPA. I see them running an REI or North Country. I'm missing my word here, or running the center at the Adirondacks. I see them as professor of biology and professor of environmental science and environmental justice because of how we do Inclusive Woods and Us. We take the whole person, the whole child. It's not just recreation for us, because as a founder, I understand the power of nature to inspire us, to increase our creativity, to help us with our retention, to allow us to be clearer thinker, more peaceful people, to create a sense of community in us where we engage with each other at a more human level, to help us to want to know and do more, to protect the environment, to be healthier all around, and also the empowerment that Woods and Us offers. Our trails, our hikes, While we have outdoor educators, we need them who are schooling the sciences. They can tell the children or the adults about the leaves and the trees and the barks and the snake type. What we do is allowing people to discover the nature that we are. We are nature. Tap into that nature and find the empowerment that I know that I have found that has helped me transition as an immigrant, and use that nature to empower them in other spaces so that they can learn better, because it shows that scientific studies people retain better, and they can then use that knowledge through woods and us to better become. So in 5 years, I see my role at Woods and Us receding and fading away. That's the kind of leader that I am. Well, I am not about creating a marquee for myself. It's to create a generation that will replace the Harcum, that will replace the Lucien, to be the next leaders running within us. That's my dream. That's what I see if I get the money to run that capacity.
And Lucien, what is the website that you want people to check out?
We are inclusivewoodsenough.org.
Inclusivewoodsenough.org. Let me read as we close a couple of emails. Emily in Brighton, I'm a white mom of black kids, and we have been in national, state, and county parks across the country. We are almost always the only black family we see in the parks. I hope that over time that will change, but I understand the discomfort of putting yourself out there in such a white space. There is strength in numbers. Let's all go to the woods. And Nick in Fairport says, I have a cottage in the North Country, and I totally get the threatening Confederate and Blue Lives Matter flags. It's scary, and I'm a white male driving a pickup truck. I want your guests to know they do belong and are loved. If any of the North Country explorers want to send me a picture of their catch, I'm currently trying to document fish species through illustration, and I'd love to collaborate. Nick in Fairport. A lot of people sharing love and appreciation, Lucien. Thank you for sharing your story. And we will, if we don't see you in the woods, we'll talk to you here sometime again. We'd love to hear what you're doing.
Thank you for having us.
Lucien Nicholson, founder and executive director of Inclusive Woods and Us. Clifton Harcum from SUNY Potsdam. Thank you, Clifton, for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Wonderful. And Chandra Pointer, event chair at REI Inclusion Network at REI in Rochester. Thanks for sharing your story as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we have more connections coming up in a moment.